Hey, y'all. How's it going? This thing on or what? All right. Good morning, you guys. Morning, chat room, guys. Hey, there's the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat, if you want to hang out in there with the boys. Looks like there's some people in there already. Could be girls, too. I don't know. Everybody's got a fake name, you know. scotthorton.org/chat, you want to hang out in there. Got a good one lined up for you today. I think Phil Giraldi is going to be on to debunk some war propaganda. And Dan Sanchez is going to be on to tell a very interesting story. And Eric Margulies is going to be on to, I think, probably debunk some war propaganda, as well as just fill us in on what the hell is going on in Yemen today. Things are going on in Yemen. Things that could be very important. So, there you go. And, boy, Dan Sanchez, he knows how to win me over. No, I mean, he wrote this great article, that came out last night, and it's now, posted as well at the antiwar.com/blog there. /blog? That's bad syntax. The blog. antiwar.com/blog. Playing with Fanatic Fire, it's called, and it's really good. And I was sitting here jotting down, oh, I gotta make sure to ask him about this, which I don't know, and then I kept reading, and yeah, he mentions it in there too, the thing I wanted to bring up. So yeah, real good. And then what was I gonna say? At the end of the article, he says, and I'm just joking, I'd interview him about this anyway. But at the end of the thing, he talks about my term backdraft. See, I tried to write an article like this one time. Backdraft, it was going to be called. But then, meh, it just wasn't that good. You know, I wrote a few paragraphs and I thought, you know, it makes for something to say on the radio. But apparently I'm not, just not that good of a writer. I don't know. I guess I can be if I'm motivated enough. But I scrapped the article. I never did write it. But don't let anybody else take credit. Dan Sanchez, he gives me credit. Backtrack. It's like blowback, only more obvious and more immediate. And, you know, honestly, I have to give credit to my confusion rather than any original idea of mine. Because when I first heard the term blowback, I confused it and thought of that movie Backdraft, with the Ron Howard movie, which I never actually saw, but I remember learning the premise of the room full of fuel and heat, but no oxygen. So the firefighter kicks in the door looking for, innocent fire victims to rescue, and he accidentally provides oxygen to the fire, to the heat and the fuel, and it blows up in his face. For those of you who didn't go to sixth grade, that's what you need for fire. Heat, fuel, oxygen. Get it, right. So, I just confused the two. And then, you know, later on I learned, I don't know how long it took me to straighten my brain out about the two different terms. But anyway, that's besides the point. What's important is that, as Chalmers Johnson explains, blowback, it was coined as a CIA term after the coup d'etat in Iran in 1953, where a CIA analyst wrote, yeah, great success, but we're going to have some real blowback coming down the line because of this, which of course was correct. But then the way they defined it, it was a CIA term. The way they defined it was the consequences of covert action, the consequences of secret foreign policies that the American people don't know about, don't understand. And so when the consequences come due, the American people, their mind basically is wide open for the government to manipulate in interpretation, really. I don't think that's how they meant it. But the people don't understand what's happening. That's why you hear people to this day all the time go, oh yeah, the Iranians, they hate us. Man, those guys, they hate us. To them, people who can even remember back to 1979, history begins in 1979. Because the reason that they were chanting death to America and burning American flags and overthrowing the government and occupying America's embassy and blaming it all on their great Satan was because America had overthrown their democratically elected government in 1953 and installed a fascist dictator, the Shah Reza Pahlavi. But the American people didn't know that. The American people thought Iran was our friend because they got the nice Shah over there and everything's fine. But they didn't realize that he was a sock puppet dictator of the USA. And that anybody in Iran would have any reason to blame America for anything that he might have done to them. And Jimmy Carter, when he was asked about that, hey, but Jimmy Carter, what about the coup in 53? He said, well, that's ancient history. Now, I have to tell you, in 2014, that is at least antique history, right? But in 1979, that was only 26 years later. 26 years later. So 26 years ago was the Reagan administration. What if the Iranians had overthrown Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and installed an Ayatollah to rule over all of us? Would that be irrelevant ancient history as far as our revolution to kill him and his buddies and force them out of our capital city? Of course not. It's crazy. But, you know, and that's Jimmy Carter, supposedly the old softy or whatever. That's his interpretation of it. What right do the Iranians have to overthrow a government that we've installed there? None. But anyway, the reason the Americans fell for it is because no one ever told them the truth about the coup in 53. I mean, nowadays, if you're interested in this kind of thing at all, everybody knows about the coup in 53. But do all Americans? No. And did any real plurality of Americans understand that back in 1979? No. They didn't. So that's why it's blowback. Same thing as September 11th. Well, you all saw those planes. They came out of the clear blue sky. What could possibly explain that? Since history began that morning, and you don't need to know about the million-something people that Bill Clinton killed with a blockade enforced from bases on the Holy Arabian Peninsula, land of Mecca and Medina, where Muhammad the Prophet was from, and how that had motivated a terrorist war against the United States. And you do remember, right? There was the Khobar Towers attack, which they tried to blame on Iran, but come on. That was an Al-Qaeda attack in 1996. Before that, really, it was the World Trade Center. That group was Islamic Jihad, but which ended up merging with the Azzam group and basically becoming Al-Qaeda together. So basically same thing, the Blind Sheikh and Zawahiri are buds. And then there's the Africa embassies in 1998 that were bombed, the USS Cole in the year 2000. But anyway, the American people, I don't know. In fact, there was a quote I read recently from a lady that on that day, and no offense to her, hey, whatever, she's just some poor lady living through this horrible attack on the United States, on the town, you know, where she is. She may have been in the building, I don't know. But from downtown New York, the day of the attack, saying, you know, because obviously it's both towers, it's a deliberate terrorist attack of some kind, right? And she's saying, but what could two office towers have to do with something political? And by something political, I mean, what could that even be, right? No connection made because no connection was ever explained leading up to it. So then it becomes wide open to interpretation. Backdraft, on the other hand, nope, that's when it's so obvious that, oh my God, look everybody, Barack Obama is backing the Mujahideen in Libya. Wow, this is going to blow up right in your face. You got the heat of their ideology. You got the fuel of their trigger fingers. And all you need is the oxygen of American intervention and weapons and money. And then, not only does it blow up and burn Gaddafi, but it blows up in America's face too. I mean, at least they got the Chinese out of there, but it's not like they pacified the place and, you know, run off with much hegemony or anything. They do have a CIA general attempting to become the Libyan al-Sisi right now, with help from the Egyptians, so fittingly. But anyway, and then the same thing in Syria. Hey, look, everybody. Barack Obama's supporting a rebellion that's led by the al-Nusra Front, which is just al-Qaeda in Iraq, we said, from 2011 on. From the first year of this thing. It's been known it's the suicide bombers and prisoner beheaders leading this rebellion. And yet they've done it anyway. No covert action about it, really. You can read about it in the American Conservative Magazine. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Am I going to watch sports on CNN, or am I going to watch sports on CNN International? Or I guess I'm going to go back to Fox News here. And they're talking about some true crime thing. Oh, well, anyway. Better off that way, right? If they're covering foreign affairs, they're just trying to scare you into making everything worse. Oh, boy. All right, well, yeah, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And thanks again to Tom Woods for having me on his show last week. That was cool, the Tom Woods Show. It's on YouTube, and it's at his website, tomwoods.com. And it's at my website, scotthorton.org, on my blog, Stress. You can find it there, and including a transcript. And, yeah, so good times there. Now, here's the thing about that was, now, what I said wasn't perfect. I went back, you know, I had to listen to it because I actually ran it as my Sunday morning interview on KPFK in Los Angeles. Let them listen to an interview of me for a change and see how that goes over. So far, I hadn't heard anything bad about it anyway, I guess. I don't know. So I had to go back and listen to it. And it's not perfect. There are a few things that I wish I had chimed in and said there. You know, here, there, the other thing. And there are places where I probably went on too long and should have let Tom have more time to ask me stuff and this and that. But, you know, it's more or less the case against intervening in Iraq. And I think I made it pretty well. That seemed to be the consensus. But then, so here's my point, and here's what's bothering me. Yeah, that's what this show's about, is things that bother me. What's bothering me is that it doesn't matter. The case against it doesn't matter at all. And in fact, like, if you pretend for just a moment and imagine a world where a compelling argument that this war is just going to blow up in our faces. It's just going to make matters worse. It's all the U.S. government's fault in the first place. And any likely scenario that you try to play out only fails. So don't. And then for that to work, I mean, even assuming the premise that it's right, just for the sake of argument, right? Who knows if I'm right or not, counterfactual, this and that, a history that'll never happen. But just pretend for a moment that the anti-war answer is really the best utilitarian answer for how ISIS is to be destroyed most efficiently and most thoroughly, most permanently. Doesn't matter, does it? They're just going to do what they want. You know, George Bush, as much as they tried to imply that Saddam had done 9/11... and more that, well, he's friends with Osama, so he might as well have, and we expect him to help with the next one and that kind of thing. They still went to Congress and said, you got to give us a brand new authorization. They tried to sort of kind of go to the UN and get some consequences promised vaguely. They went through the motions. Colin Powell said, hey, man, we got to at least pretend to try to go to the UN on this. And we're, right now, we've come so far where, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of Americans don't even know America had a war with Libya back in 2011. Certainly they don't know anything about American support for, or maybe they've heard some, the support for the rebellion in Syria all this time. But here we're going back to a full-scale war in Iraq that they promise is going to take years. Up front, they're going, oh, yeah, we're just going to be escalating this thing for years here. And they're not even going to Congress. It's not even a big deal. The other Scott Horton was on the show last week to describe just what a joke the legalities are here. That, you know, War Powers Act certainly doesn't apply in this situation. The AUMF from 2001 does not apply. the AOMF against Iraq to go and rid Saddam Hussein of his WMD sure as hell doesn't apply. And so, you know, Maliki, they say, is, you know, or not Maliki, Abadi, the new, same difference, the new Maliki, from the same party in Baghdad, has asked for our help, but that just assumes the premise that Western and Northwestern Baghdad actually, or Iraq, actually belongs to Baghdad. But it seems to me like they've declared independence and pretty much enforced it. Not that the Islamic State is a member in good standing of the UN or anything, but still, it is a state. I don't think it has to be a member in good standing of the UN at all, does it? I don't know. That's why they keep saying, don't call it the Islamic State. It's not a state. Because otherwise they would need a UN resolution. Although, what's the point of that? It's not like anyone can prosecute the Americans. There is no world law other than as enforced by the Americans. So, they have sovereign immunity from prosecution for anything they might do. Imagine a situation where America doesn't go to war here. Oh yeah, there's a bunch of bin Ladenites took over some territory, and it's all America's fault. Meh. Oh well. Let it be. Let's see what happens. You know, this is all the last government and this one's fault anyway, so maybe we can just sit back and let it work itself out, you know? Can you imagine? It doesn't matter that that really is the best answer. And here's why that's really the best answer. Because Americans, even though most of the army is probably, you know, blacks and Mexicans, basically they're representing white Christians from the other side of the ocean who speak an entirely different language. And so they might as well be Shia from Iran from the point of view of the Islamic State. If they really don't put American soldiers, I mean, already the special forces are there, of course, but they don't put the Army and Marine Corps there, but they just fly air missions in support of the Shiite army and the Shiite militias, all backed by the Iranians, then that just blows up in our face even more. That just recruits people to their cause even more and reinforces the idea that America is, well, from the Sunnis' point of view, on the Shiite side of the sectarian war, where, of course, as you can read about in the New York Times, and it's a little bit true, the Shiites are convinced that this entire jihad is a project of the United States. That ISIS works for the CIA, and that the whole thing is a plot against them by America, too. And, of course, they're both right to a certain degree. Not that ISIS really works for the CIA. The CIA has been backing different groups, but they have been certainly providing the space for ISIS to take over. As I've said a lot of times before, this war would have been over in 2011 if America and America's satellite states hadn't been intervening over there. Assad would have won, and there would have been no Islamic State in the West at all. Anyway, that's just what is killing me, is I think I made a pretty good case, and I think a lot of people, you know, checking out all the op-eds that are coming out and stuff, there's a lot of people get it, a lot of people calling out this strategy, but it seems like mostly it just means they need more troops rather than do less, do more, as usual. Shrug.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Where sometimes I talk funny. And other times I mispronounce things. Giraldi, Sanchez, Margulies today on the show. Should be good. All right, so, by special request, this is the part of the show where I review 60 Minutes from last night. Didn't watch it. Okay, I watched it this morning. 60 Minutes. Scott Pelley. Anyway, so here's the thing about it, man. Very heavy on assertions of war crimes. Oh, the tragedy of it all. And the truth is that, yeah, it's horrible. And the crying lady saying she desperately wants to know what happened to her mother, I don't know. She's probably not faking it. I don't know. I don't in any way think that any anti-war person in any way needs to dispute whether these ISIS guys like killing civilians. They like killing civilians. They're fanatical civilian killers. They're really bad guys. It's unfortunate that that plays into war propaganda. Oh, the babies on the cold floor and the Iraqi army stole all their incubators and Belgian babies on bayonets and these kinds of things. If that's all it takes to whoop the American people up to get them back into a war, then, as I've been warning for a while now, there's not going to be any shortage of atrocities to point to. I've seen videos that these guys put out over on LiveLeak and whatever that the ISIS guys themselves have put out of them lining up Shia in ditches and massacring them all. And not all soldiers, there are different videos. Some of them, they're killed just for being Shia. And, you know, that's really what they're about. They're really bad guys. Now, but here's the thing about it. For that to be what 60 Minutes is about, oh, look at what fanatical bad guys these are, is for them to deliberately try to mislead you with the trees and make you miss the forest. And what's much more important, I don't know, more important. What's a major part of the argument that they leave out right there is that the locals hate them too, because they are totalitarian, civilian, butchering monsters. They're not good for anything except fighting and killing. And I mean worse than your local police department. Out of control. And so, they carry with them the seeds of their own destruction everywhere they go. And they just happen to have the worst part of Iraq. There are some oil resources, but basically it's the least developed oil resources in the country. They could maybe see some more oil, but they would have a fight on their hands from the Peshmerga for Kirkuk, with or without America's help. I think it's doubtful that they could drive the Peshmerga out of Kirkuk, honestly. They're really not that much of a threat. And something that they never talk about on TV, but has been covered on this show by quite a many expert types, with some dissent, is that these guys need us to attack. They need to be seen as defending the pure Islamic caliphate, just like it's supposed to be, from the Americans who would dare to try to destroy it. And then they have their great argument, all we need is faith and bravery and we'll be fine and keep fighting and all that crap. And the most America could do, just look at it right now, you already know it. The most America could do is change them from the Islamic State back into Al-Qaeda in Iraq again. Basically. Turn them back into an insurgency. You can't just eradicate them without hydrogen bombs, which can't use hydrogen bombs. So, it is what it is. They're going to do it anyway. It's funny, man. Part of the problem here is the journalist. You know, Scott Pelley, I give him credit. He's been to more war zones than me. And yet, he's looking through a soda straw, as Robert Gates might say. He's failing to ask all the right questions. Like, tell me how this ends, or anything like that. And so, the story basically comes in a couple of parts. First, these guys kill civilians because they're really bad guys. Are you upset? Okay, you're nice and upset. All right, now here's the Viagra commercial. And then, okay, now that we're back from the Viagra commercial. We promise relief, you know? A little bit more on some atrocities. And now, let's talk about how, you know whose fault this really is. Because we know you were thinking during the Viagra ad that, man, if only George Bush hadn't overthrown the government there and everything. But no, you know whose fault it really is Maliki. Not that it's Bush's fault for picking Maliki. Remember, because they debothified the government and abolished the army, they were stuck with a coalition of Sadr, the Dawa Party, and the Supreme Islamic Council. And they chose the Dawa Party, and I guess Sadr and Skiri compromised because they each had their own army, and Dawa didn't have an army. So they kind of compromised and said, you know, or militia, you know. So they kind of compromised and said, okay, we'll support the Dawa guys. So first they put in Ibrahim Jafari, but you know what? We just don't like Ibrahim Jafari. So then they got rid of him and they put in Nouri al-Maliki. And then there's George W. Bush being quoted as saying, Maliki, oh, that Maliki is an SOB. Really? Well, you're the one who made him the prime minister of Iraq. Not the Iraqi people, not even the Shia Arabs of Iraq made him the prime minister. You did. And then there's Panetta saying, yeah, he was supposed to compromise with the Sunnis. He was supposed to share. He was supposed to try to get along. And he never really did. But with no acknowledgement of the fact of why not. Because he had no incentive to whatsoever. Why not? Because America didn't just invade. America stayed. And America stayed long enough to help the Shiite militias kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and make it an 85% Shiite city. So they didn't have any incentive whatsoever left to compromise with the Sunnis. Screw you guys. We got the capital city and it'll take you 100 years to take it back now. Thanks, America, for stealing it for us. Now you can get the hell out, they said. And then they replace Maliki with who? With this guy, Abadi, who's from the Dawa Party too, just like Jafari and Maliki before him. He's just made Jafari his foreign minister, ba-dum-psh, and Maliki is one of the vice presidents. A hearty har-har. Oh, but now, you know what he's going to do? He's just going to turn over half all the oil wealth in the country and put all the Sunni Arabs on welfare and bribe them into not liking this Baghdadi guy no more. You think so, huh? You think he's even going to try, huh? Come on. This is so ridiculous. And, you know, you go back and read Robert Dreyfus writing in 2003 and 2004 saying, look, man, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party, when they say strong federalism, they mean break Iraq into three like Joe Biden wants. You know, like the Israelis want. And exclude the Sunnis. And it's Sadr who, among the Shia with power, wanted to create a nationalist coalition against Iran and America. But America chose Iran's sock puppets on the bet that they would need the U.S. more than they needed Iran. Well, didn't quite turn out that way. Until now, I guess. Now America's going to be flying drones and F-18s as air cover for Iranian-backed militias out there killing ISIS guys. And this is going to go on for how long again? And now, I don't know if it'll get quite as violent as back in 2006 and 7, like Matthew Ho is predicting, just because Baghdad's already taken. The Islamic State has no ability to take it back from the Shiites, especially not backed by Iran and America. And I don't think that the Shiites are going to cross the lines into Sunni territory either. So I don't think the fighting will be as fierce, but it's still going to be horrible. Probably a big fight over Kirkuk is what's coming between the Kurds and the Islamic State. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, welcome back. I'm Scott. Ow, ain't too good at talking. All right, y'all. Yeah, it's the show, the Scott Horton Show, talking about the 60 Minutes thing last night. So, one part atrocity stories. I'm warning you, those are just going to keep coming. And probably most of them will be true because there's really no need to lie. Because these ISIS guys, they are a bunch of Zarqawiites, man. That's who they are. They're Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're the guys who specialize in bombing marketplaces full of women and children. Because they really suck. And because it's part of their strategy. The strategy of savagery, I think Lawrence Wright called it in a recent column. So you're going to get that. Anyway, 60 Minutes last night. Part one, atrocity stories. Part two, oh, you know whose fault this all is? Not the United States of America. Not George W. Bush and the entire consensus of the entire establishment, every single think tank, and both leaderships of both political parties, etc., 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 for invading Iraq and staying, and all the horror that they cause, and destabilization and deprivation. Grief. And picking Maliki, who they're blaming. And as someone on Twitter pointed out this morning, Rupert Stone pointed out, yeah, and also who helped Maliki stay in power in 2010 after he lost the election to Iyad Alawi's group? Iyad Alawi, who used to work for Saddam and then worked for the CIA and then worked for directly for George Bush, basically, as the sock puppet prime minister of Iraq for an entire year under American occupation. The people of Iraq preferred him to Maliki. Sunni and Shia, they all participated in the 2010. And Alawi's group, well, see, what happened was he won the plurality, but not the majority. But then instead of going with the constitutional system and having the runoff or whatever, they just worked it out. And, of course, the compromise was between America and Iran. Okay, we'll go ahead and keep the Dawa party guy. Amazing. And so, yeah, very good point. So, that's worth making. And then, here's the other thing. Part three of the war propaganda on 60 Minutes last night was about what's going on in Syria. And now, you know, I don't think I've ever seen such a thing in my life as the just insanity of this propaganda about Syria. I mean, I don't know. Back when they were spinning Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq as any sort of threat to even its neighbors, much less the world in 2003, for people who weren't stupid and up to their eyeballs in slogans, that was pretty ridiculous. As Ron Paul pointed out in October of 2002, he hasn't been able to shoot down a single one of our airplanes patrolling over his airspace in 12 years. Not a single one. He has no air force. None. He has no navy. His GDP is in the negative nothing. Are you kidding me? That was pretty damn ridiculous, okay? I concede that. But now, this spin, and I watched a little bit of the rerun of some more of the Kerry hearing. I never got to see the whole thing. The Kerry hearing from last week, I saw it this morning on TV. Same thing on 60 Minutes last night. This spin that all America needs to do is back the moderate rebels. That's the plan now. And according to 60 Minutes, this is Obama conceding that this was the right thing to do all along. And there's Leon Panetta, who was his Secretary of Defense at the time, saying, we never should have withdrew from Iraq, even though he was the one who withdrew them from Iraq. I don't remember him resigning over that. Nouri al-Maliki and the victorious Democratic Dawa Party told America, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out to Kuwait. Bye. No immunity for you. Beat it. They're the majority. Bush put the majority in power. They didn't need us anymore. And Panetta withdrew them. Panetta himself was the Secretary of Defense at the time. He goes, I can't believe Obama withdrew the soldiers. If only the soldiers had still been there. Really, huh? All right. And then he goes on. If only Obama had backed the moderate rebels and built a real ruling coalition and a real moderate army to fight Assad, then ISIS wouldn't have been able to grow up in that space. But that is just crazy. No one who's, I mean, I don't know anybody who actually believes that other than just liars say that. It's ridiculous. You can read Mark Lynch in the Washington Post weeks and weeks ago, and that's as official a debunking as I can think of off of the top of my head right now, but there's 100 of them. Read at foreignpolicy.com, probably at foreignaffairs.com. You can read about how there never was any kind of group that could have been the ruling council of moderates. When you say the moderates, all you mean are jihadists who are willing to accept guns from Americans, really. As Patrick Coburn's been saying on this show and in print at The Independent for years, he asked them all, FSA or any of the other groups, what do you think about 9/11? And they all say, hell yeah, fight the Americans, holy jihad, blah, blah, blah. Hillary Clinton, I've played the clip 100 times, said there's really no one to work with. We don't see that in Syria, anyone to work with. She tried 2 or even 3 times in 2012 to set up these ruling councils, Friends of Syria, ruling moderates. They had no credibility at all. And their desperate chances at credibility were expressed in their endorsement of the al-Nusra Front that had sworn their allegiance to al-Qaeda. They're just the Syrian veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, mostly, from the last war. And every time she set up a ruling council, they would endorse al-Nusra. Because they had to, because those were the only guys with any credibility fighting on the ground, because they're the only guys fighting on the ground. Moderates mostly means big fat expats sitting at a hotel in Qatar or in Turkey, ordering other people around. The guys who are out there voluntarily fighting in volunteer militias, sorry I used volunteer twice in a statement like that, it doesn't sound like good writing, but anyway, those guys going up against a state army backed by Russia and Hezbollah, those guys are not moderates. Those guys aren't afraid of dying. Those guys don't mind dying at all. They're in it to win it for real. And there they go doing, you know, suicide attacks. And like I said, the strategy of savagery, cutting people's heads off, crucifying them, suicide bombing women and children in order to terrorize the hell out of people. It's a force multiplier. You understand? That's what it is. Nobody wants to get caught by these guys, so run rather than risk it. That's basically, you know, what you're supposed to, their victims are supposed to calculate. So there are no moderates, and they say now they're going to take 5,000 of the most moderate fighters they can find, and they're going to send them to Saudi Arabia for a year? Huh? Wait, anyway, no, back to the past of Panetta blaming Obama for not doing enough to back the moderate rebels there. Put yourself in Obama's shoes. He's obviously, what he did was he compromised. He said, look, we'll let Saudi and Qatar and Turkey do as much as they want. We'll have the CIA, you know, help with some guns for the FSA and this kind of thing. But very wary of shoulder fired surface to air missiles. Very wary of anything beyond anti-tank missiles. Because, as Panetta said, honestly, to Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes last night, the president was afraid of the weapons getting in the hands of the wrong people. And then he said, but my answer to that is, well, you got to start somewhere. You got to start by arming people who are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri and al-Qaeda. ISIS only split off from al-Nusra, not over any kind of different ideology other than who's got to follow whose orders and who has, you know, what strategy on what timetable. Otherwise, they're still Zarqawiites, Zawahiriites, if you like, in every other way. And then there's an article today by Josh Rogan, a well-reported piece by Josh Rogan. And I know that he's a bit hawkish, but he's an honest guy, I think. He is a kind of a neoconish reporter, but I don't think he's dishonest. I think he does pretty damn good journalism. I've talked with him a few times. He's got a good article today at the Daily Beast about how, guess who, we're finding out now, were the moderates that sold Stephen Sotloff to ISIS. According to Sotloff's people, and he has other sources verifying it too, it was the Northern Storm Brigade. John McCain's friends. Now, the government's denying it, but as I tweeted to Rogan here, they told Time magazine before McCain went to party with them, and wanted to spend the night with them, that they were veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Their commander said he was a veteran of the war against Americans in Iraq. The moderates. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show here, noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network on the weekdays. On the line, I got Phil Giraldi. He's a former CIA and DIA officer, and now he is the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, which sponsors this show, and as you hear during the commercial breaks. And also, he writes for the American Conservative magazine at theamericanconservative.com. And for uns.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Oh, yeah, I meant to say your latest article at the American Conservative is called Obama's Failed Foreign Policy Change. We're running it today at antiwar.com in the viewpoint section there. And, yeah, we're going to talk a bit about that big picture stuff here in a minute. But first of all, I wanted to ask you about what must be a bunch of crap put out by the government and the major media about a brand new Al-Qaeda group, a brand new Zarqawi break-off sect, something called the Khorasan, which is sure to cut off all of our heads soon. What do you say?
Well, I think, you know, these groups definitely exist, but, you know, they kind of exist in the sense that they have a website in which they threaten to do this, that, and the other thing, and then you have dubious intelligence reports coming in from here and there, you know, saying that this is for real this time. This guy is a former Al-Qaeda, and he was involved with 9/11, and he's the founder, and there are all these militants from Western Europe and the United States that are going to be unleashed upon us. You know, there's a kernel of truth to all this stuff, but the problem is, you know, you have to decide is on balance the whole story credible? Are we really under siege by all these guys with beards who while they may have ambitions, at the same time don't really have any easy way to get to the United States or even to get to most places in Western Europe? So, you know, what is the threat? I mean, the threat is obviously being engineered by people who have a vested interest in keeping the threat going. I would suspect a lot of the information about Khorasan, for example, might come from somebody like Rita Katz, who makes a very fine living out of conflating these claims by various terrorist groups and selling them to Citibank and others. You know, it's a business. It's a racket.
Yeah. I mean, they are, as you describe them, basically pirates without a ship, and we are way safe over here in the New World to a degree. On the other hand, it seems like, well, I don't know, Phil, I guess I'm just a paranoid by nature, and it seems to me like these guys probably would want to attack us if they could try to get Americans to escalate the war over there more. I think that's probably, they think, in their interest to do, as they keep trying to bait us into, you know, calling Obama a coward and all this stuff, as they do, cutting people's heads off. And I also think that on any given day, the FBI is way too busy entrapping some idiot into saying Osama is my hero or whatever than they are actually doing any kind of decent job tracking which Americans have gone to Syria to fight and where they are, et cetera. You had this one kook from Florida who went to Syria to fight, came back, hung around for a while, went back to Syria and did a suicide attack. So it's not hard to see how that kook could have just stayed here. And, you know, meanwhile, Homeland Security and all them are sitting around doing anything but actually protecting Americans. So it doesn't seem like that much of a feat for one of these guys to get on a plane. And then, you know, one person could do a lot of damage with one rifle in the right circumstances, you know, with the right soft target to hit, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. I mean, there's no reason to assume that these guys are incapable of doing anything. But the problem is we've created a monster here. They know that every time they make a comment on the internet and it gets picked up inevitably by Rita Katz or by an intelligence agency, it's going to scare everybody, and we'll spend another $10 billion on doing something we don't have to do. Sure, if one of these guys actually gets over here, has the means, now you got to connect all these dots. They have to, first of all, be able to get over here, which ain't an easy thing anymore. And then they've got to be able to come up with some weapons, or they've got to come up with a bomb, or they've got to come up with this, or they've got to come up with that. And they have to get into a situation where they get through whatever security is existing and actually get there and ignite it. Yeah, sure, they can really do some serious damage, kill a lot of people. But, you know, does this threaten the country? And is this something that we should be on high alert for the rest of our lives about? And that's what bothers me, because they keep, you know, the intelligence people, it's not so much the intelligence people, it's the political guys. It's the guys at the top of Homeland Security or in the White House who are always talking about these threats. I think the intelligence people have a pretty good perspective on how serious they are or not serious they are. But the guys who want to politicize this stuff, it's because they want to leave the impression that the government is doing a great job protecting us. We need another $100 billion and we'll be even safer. You know, it's this kind of thinking, and I think we've got to walk away from that thinking. Sure, people are going to get killed by terrorists in the future in the United States. There's no question about it. But, you know, we have 35,000 people killed every year by cars. The question becomes, at what point does it become a government responsibility to spend tons of money on a threat that might be, you know, a tiny fraction of 1% viable?
Right. Well, see, and that's my specific fear, isn't so much like I'm going to be hurt or anyone I care about is going to be hurt, or even that Americans in any kind of large numbers are going to be hurt. You know, I would think the maximum damage in my nightmare scenario would be maybe a couple of dozen people shot before somebody shoots the evil terrorist or whatever. That's nothing, right? That's not even a pinprick. But what my fear is the reaction. That, like, all right, that's it. We're going to nuke Tehran now or whatever. Who knows what madness could come from something like that. If we can have a full-scale Iraq War 3 breaking out now just because of a couple of beheading videos, then what if somebody really shot up a damn ball game in a real bad way? You know what I mean? Like, who knows what kind of crazy thing would happen? So it's not, you know, my fear isn't to, like, try to, you know, accentuate the war propaganda that, yeah, we all need to live in fear and go fight. It's my fear is that if something happens, we're going to go fight even more, create, you know, as Hosni Mubarak said before the attack on Iraq in 2003, said, if you do this, you're going to create 10,000 bin Ladens. Before there were 200 of these guys, really, he was kind of right. I mean, at least 10,000 Zarqawis, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. But let's look at it another way. No matter what we do, even if we spend this $100 billion, there's still going to be terrorist attacks in the United States. They're going to happen. Just because in a country as big as this, with big, relatively open borders and so on and so forth, it's just going to happen. You have to accept it's going to happen. So should we be spending the $100 billion to, you know, to line the pockets of politicians and beltway bandits, or should we just accept that this is the reality of the world that we have created? Let's not forget that point. We have created, as you point out with Mubarak's comment, this is a world that we've created. And now all of a sudden we're not too happy with it. Gee, there are a lot of terrorists out there.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's their spin on it. If you put the war party to the wall on this, they'll say, okay, well, so maybe George Bush's war did lead to a lot of this. But anyway, that's still the past, and we still have to do something about it. Now, you know, their thing, basically they made the nightmare of that war propaganda from back then come true, in a sense. Again, not that these guys have ready access to the North American continent. Obviously, it's not so simple, but it's sure, you know, northwestern Iraq sure wasn't like this 13 years ago.
Yeah. Well, it gets complicated. Obviously, the terrorism is for real. These people are not nice. But, you know, this the thing that astonishes me is this constant citation of the threat of the Western jihadis, of the people that have gone to join the fighters. But I don't know if I'm missing something here, but if you look at what evidence is produced about these so-called Western jihadis, I mean, they're not white people. I mean, they're basically Muslims. They're very identifiable in terms of their travel patterns. I'm sure they're being profiled like crazy by intelligence services and by the police and by border protection and all this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly like they're just because they were raised in France or something like that, that they're going to have an easy ride moving around the world. I mean, it's not going
to
happen.
Hold it right there, Phil. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Phil Drolley in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi. He wrote this thing at theamericanconservative.com, Obama's failed foreign policy change. Yeah, not much change to it. Could be worse, I guess, but then again, it's getting worse right now in a real bad way. And so I think I got to ask you about this, Phil. You are the first guy to write, and it was, again, in the American Conservative magazine. Would have been December 2011 that Obama had signed a new finding authorizing covert action in Syria and in Iran. And in Syria, that meant support for the rebels to some degree. And now, so that was the very end, December again, 2011. And there had already been some kind of things going on there for a little while with the Saudis, et cetera, earlier in 2011. But anyway, I don't know exactly when that finding you're referring to was signed, now that I think about it. Story broke in December. But anyway, so since then, there's been at least a half-hearted attempt by the Americans to support the rebels, maybe only to guarantee a no-win grind rather than a real regime change, or maybe they gave up on regime change at a certain point, something like that. But it certainly has seemed to me, for what I know, that when the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks are doing all what they do to support al-Nusra Front, the Ahrar al-Sham, and the Islamic Front, and whatever other groups that they've been supporting all this time, that basically that's just plausible deniability for the Americans having their satellites do it. But it's really an American policy to support this thing the whole time. And now that it's blown up in everybody's face that ISIS has taken all this territory and declared a caliphate, when really they're not any different than al-Nusra, who the Americans have been tolerating all along here, and hoping to, in effect, support. Now, Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, Hillary Clinton, and the rest of them are saying, see, we told you we should have supported the moderate rebels more then. And now, because Obama failed to do enough, that's what Panetta, who was, again, Secretary of Defense at the time, told 60 Minutes, and it aired last night, you may have seen. What do you make of that? Is that really right? Do you think that Obama could have created a moderate army that could have marginalized or even defeated Assad and prevented the rise of al-Nusra and ISIS?
Well, I think Obama has only spoken the truth once, and that's when he said that an army made up of shopkeepers and accountants and people who fix cars were never going to be able to overthrow Assad. That was a fiction. Did he call it a fiction, or did he say it was a fantasy?
Thanks.
It was a fantasy that we ever thought that there was an opposition that was both Western-looking and capable of doing this. So that's the only time he's spoken the truth. This other stuff is all nonsense. There was never any real serious capability apart from other major powers intervening in Syria, which kind of happened on the sneak anyway, to overthrow Assad. So it's the whole thing is like this horrible story that's been concocted and keeps growing different kind of appendages, you know, this is this and this is that. But of course, it's all bull. And certainly when somebody like Clinton or indeed the president comes out with a lot of self-justifying stuff about what we should have done, you know they're lying.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, they sound like a bunch of Keynesian economists really saying, you know, like Paul Krugman saying, see, you just didn't inflate enough. This is actually their policy. And so now, well, let me ask for a little clarification here, because I didn't go back and reread the article. I should have, Phil. But was that the finding in 2011? And a finding is a piece of paper signed by the president ordering the CIA to go ahead and break the law or do whatever they want, right? And was that
saying, right.
Work with the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks in order to finance this so-called revolution here?
No, I think there was still an illusion going on at that time that that the Saudis and the Turks and Qataris were somehow on our side, and that we all understood what the game was. But in fact, all of those countries have been playing their own game right from the beginning. I'm quite astonished that I keep learning more and more about what the Turks were up to, because the Turks are acting completely outside their own interests. In terms of the what they've stirred up in Syria, in terms of the refugee problem they have now, in terms of everything else, mm-hmm. and security and everything, but the Qataris and Saudis, obviously their dedication to Sunni revolution, as it were, is something that should have been more transparent.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're talking about what's coming out more and more about the Turks, it's their support for the al-Nusra Front, sworn to Zawahiri, just like Hirsch said in his sermon.
And for ISIS. There was an article in the Turkish media this weekend about ISIS supporters openly recruiting in Istanbul. The article, unless it was a fake, was, you know, complete with pictures and accounts of who had suborned by them and so on and so forth. It was it's quite an eye-opener. Mm.
These are our NATO allies.
Yeah.
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 Well, so now here's the thing about it. I mean, I'm willing to, it's my premise even that these guys are basically a bunch of dimwits and they're so self-interested that they can possibly have time to be interested in much of the facts or anything. On the other hand, come on. Everybody knows that al-Nusra and then Nusra and ISIS have been the leaders of this rebellion, the suicide bomber, prisoner beheader kind of kooks. And they have just kept doing this and doing this. So, is that not on purpose? Didn't they know? I mean, I know that they don't read every single thing that Patrick Coburn writes the way I do or whatever, but they must have had some idea that they're taking a real risk here in supporting these groups.
Yeah, I agree with you. This whole Syria thing has been a mystery to me right from the beginning, because it never made any sense. If there were any, let's not put lipstick on the pig about Assad. He's a tyrant and a murderer, mm-hmm. but he's not unique. And certainly, if we were seriously interested in avoiding a civil war that has killed what now 200,000 Syrians, we would not have gotten into this game. And instead, all we've done is enable that killing to happen. And you get a guy like Obama who pretends to have a conscience. This blood is on his hands, you know. And I'd like to see some accountability someday in the U.S. government, but I probably will never see that. And but it's just that we become a creature of our own kind of fiction that we've drawn up about how we're a force. Hillary Clinton in her review of Henry Kissinger's book, it was a replay of the Madeleine Albright stuff about how we are the country that sees far. We have to exert our leadership for liberal principles and democracy and freedom for all. I mean, this is bullshit.
Yeah, it's crazy that they continue to try to push it, too, in the face of all of this. But did you see the piece at the National Interest where they did the poll where more Americans than ever say that the U.S. government should be doing less around the world? And then they also say that, yes, any pretext will do for any war anywhere on the planet at any time. Go right ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly what, and indeed what's going on now in Syria is an indication that clearly is the way the government sees itself. I mean, there were a few people spoke out against Obama taking unilateral action, as it were, but not very many. And the votes in both houses of Congress were pretty heavily in favor of doing this kind of thing. And these people are just delusional.
Yeah, well, okay, so wait a minute now, because you're absolutely right about that. I mean, it is absolutely just crazy to sit and watch a Senate hearing where John McCain is telling the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, well, what if Assad attacks the FSA? Are you going to defend them from him then? And he's just trying to ignore the possibility that that could even happen. No, our policy is we're going to turn the FSA into a 100% anti-ISIS organization. And Assad, why, he's just going to play freeze tag for a minute and just sit there and do nothing for a while, and everything's just going to be... So, in other words, you know, what do you expect to happen here, Phil, when if they actually implement the policy based on their, you know, ridiculous kind of narrative that they've set up about backing these moderates against all comers?
Well, it cannot turn out well. I mean, there's just no way that there is any dynamic here that can be exploited or twisted to turn out well. And another thing I noticed last week, I'm sure you saw the article, but Dempsey said at one point that if we're going to bomb Syria, right, we're going to do it without Syria's permission. This is an act of war. We're attacking Syria, basically. And it was Dempsey or one of his people at the Pentagon said, look, and if Syria tries to defend itself, we will retaliate. And, you know, we're attacking another country which we're not at war with. It would seem to me that the right of that country to defend itself is inherent. And we're saying we're going to retaliate against somebody defending themselves against us. I mean, my God, the fact that we can even twist our tongues around these kinds of formulations just is scary. I mean, it's just, it's like we've totally lost our minds in the last 15 years or so.
Yeah, I think you live too close to Washington, D.C., the way you say we all the time. But then again, no, you know, the American people, again, just go along. 70-something percent say go ahead and bomb. Just don't send Johnny this time.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, hell, we're over time. I'll let you go, Phil, but thanks very much for doing the show again. I appreciate it.
Okay, Scott, no problem. Hopefully it'll be a better world the next time we talk.
I'm sure it will. By leaps and bounds. All right, all right. That's Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest. That's the America lobby in Washington, D.C., and also he writes for the American Conservative Magazine and UNZ.com, UNZ.com. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. More than 3,500 interviews now in the archives at scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show, etc., etc. Okay, next up is Dan Sanchez from the Mises Academy, joining us by Skype, and he's got this great article. It's running in a few different places here at Medium and at dansanchez.me and here at antiwar.com/blog. It's called Playing with Fanatic Fire, How the Saudis and the U.S. Have Perilously Exploited Radical Islam in Their Pursuit of Power. And wow, what a bunch of really great work you did on this thing. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Dan?
Thanks. I'm great. Great to be here, Scott.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show. It's a hell of a great story. War is the health of the state, even if you're on the other side, far over there, too, huh?
Exactly. Really, I wanted to provide context for the current controversy over funding Syrian rebels in order to fight ISIS, which is what Washington wants to do, mm-hmm. and how Saudi Arabia has long been helping with that Saudis have been funding radical Sunni Islamist jihadist rebels in Syria, and that has really fed into the ranks of ISIS, because these are just fellow travelers of ISIS and potential recruits. So it really launched the crisis. And so I wanted to provide the historical context to show that this has been a long time policy for both U.S. and Saudis. And not just a policy for the Saudis, but it's sort of the just the in the existential DNA of the Saudis. It's what their monarchy is predicated on. And it goes all the way back to the 1700s, when Ibn Saud, the founder of the House of Saud, the Saudi dynasty, first met Al-Wahhab, who was the founder of Wahhabism, Wahhabi Islam. And they made a deal. Saud would spread Al-Wahhab's doctrine through force, both through conquest and through inculcation, indoctrinating the subjects. And Wahhab, in exchange, would preach the sanctity of Saud's rule, and also animate Ibn Saud's conquest through his doctrine of intolerant fanaticism. Especially important is the doctrine of takfir, which defines deviant Muslims as non-Muslims, which makes it easier to war against them. And so this 1744 pact has held ever since between the Al Saud family and the descendants of Al Wahhab to this day. Actually, it's not just the royal dynasty, but the actual clerics, the highest level clerics of Wahhabism are still descendants of Al Wahhab. And it really gets at this great quote from Rothbard that I included, where he talks about how the state's age-old alliance with the court intellectuals who weave the apologia for state rule. And he goes on to say that the religious mode of this is just the earliest example of this more general phenomenon. And so these two men, they really discovered a extremely volatile blend of what I call the defining chemical formula for state power, which is dogma propagating violence mixed with violence sanctifying dogma. And that led to the bloody rise of the first Saudi state. And I talk about this great two articles by Alastair Crook, who is a diplomat and a British diplomat and intelligence officer who wrote these two articles for the Huffington Post about Saudi history. And he writes about this 1801 attack on the holy city of Karbala in Iraq and how they massacred thousands of Shiites, including women and children. And so he really compares that to what ISIS is doing in Iraq now too, especially with Shiites. Eventually, the Ottoman Empire crushed the first Saudi state by 1818. But the Wahhabi gene lay dormant in this one particular town, but not eradicated for a whole century until World War I. And so I can pick up the story there later, or if you have follow-up questions.
Yeah, no, go right ahead. We still have a couple of minutes to the first break, and I'm just sitting here listening and learning. I think it's really important, of course, the end of the Ottoman Empire and the so-called independence of the Arabian states thereafter.
Right. So just sort of like how knocking out Saddam Hussein and knocking out Gaddafi in Libya and trying to knock out Assad in Syria, how that just led to this chaos where these radical groups could flower. When the Ottoman power was crushed in World War I, that laid the groundwork for the Wahhabi gene to become pestilential again, to become really active again. And so what happened is that the second great Saudi conquest happened, and it was chiefly manned by this one militia called the Ikhwan, A-I-K-H-W-A-N, which is a militia of former Bedouins that were indoctrinated by Wahhabist clerics, and they were the most zealous, most fanatic forces that the new Ibn Saud. There was a new ruler also called Ibn Saud in this new era that he used them to conquer Arabia again, and this tidal wave was just as ruthless and bloody as the first. According to some estimates, it involved 40,000 public executions and 350,000 amputations. So again, pre-echoes of ISIS's rampage. So, but what a point that I try to make is that when you're playing with fire, you're going to get burnt. And the Ikhwan, their fires of fanaticism, always would threaten to burn the Saudis themselves. Saudis were trying to cultivate favor with the British and trying to stay on their good side, but the Ikhwan didn't want to yield. They wanted to go ahead and conquer British protectorates. And so when the Saudis tried to hold them back, they bridled and they revolted and threatened to overthrow the Sauds. They were finally crushed in 1929, but then what I show in the essay is that this is a recurring threat that that occurred over and over again throughout Saudi history and might even be occurring today with ISIS.
Mm. Yeah, well, that certainly raises the question of, you know, just what's going on bubbling beneath the surface there in Saudi Arabia right now. I think you say that when they were crushed, that meant that, well, I guess they were beaten, but then also they were incorporated into the state security forces as well. I deal with the devil kind of a thing there, huh? Is that right?
Right. Right, they were the ones that stayed loyal were integrated into the Saudi National Guard,
which is, of course, the only purpose for their military. Since America fights all their other wars for them, it's just for keeping their own people down, keeping them in line there. Go ahead.
Oh, so their integration into the National Guard actually would prove to be a threat later on. Later in the 20th century, it was descendants of these same Ikhwan who led a 1970 revolt against the Saudi monarchy when they seized the Grand Mosque in Mecca.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we'll have to stop right there and go out to this break. When we get back, more with Dan Sanchez. He wrote this great thing. You can find it at antiwar.com/blog, Playing with Fanatic Fire. And I got some follow-up questions, and you should read this thing, man. It's really good. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Talking with Dan Sanchez about the compromise between the rulers, the ruling family, really, of Saudi Arabia and the clerics who keep the people enthralled, basically. Like the old days, only in modern times. Cutting people's heads off with swords for being convicted of sorcery and this kind of thing. Those are recent headlines. Let's see where we left off. It was the 70s. You say there was another revolt by these guys who were always just the Islamists who were just being barely kept in check at all times. And then, as you say in the article, they were kind of bought off with oil wealth. I guess they had adjusted the cost of their oil for 1970s value dollars finally, and were able to spend some of that wealth, tamping things down the gentler way, with carrots rather than sticks, I guess. But then came the 1980s war in Afghanistan, and a great way to get rid of all these guys, at least for a little while, and then who cares what happens after that, right?
Yeah, there was kind of a couple different new phases after oil was discovered. And oil was able to fuel what I call soft power jihad, that, with the realities of the American hegemon, they couldn't just conquer new lands anymore. So the Saud dynasty couldn't hold up their end of the bargain to the Wahhabi clerics in that regard by spreading the faith in that way. So instead, they used soft power money is funded by oil wealth. Even before the 70s, they had done this to a great degree. In 1962, they started the World Muslim League, which try to combat secular and socialist Islam ideologies throughout the world. And that, of course, dovetailed nicely with Cold War aims of the United States. And then after the 1970s, when the oil wealth increased, they were also able to fund, use that to fund what I call covert hard power jihad, including, as you say, the Afghanistan jihad, which included, of course, Osama bin Laden, and Zarqawi got there late, but he was the one who founded ISIS, basically. But then things got tense again with the Gulf War, because there was the United States used Saudi land to stage airstrikes on Iraq, on Saddam, and that was really upsetting. So in the New Yorker, this article that you turned me onto, I'm so glad that your synapses were able to discover it, because it was such a great article that really informed this essay, just about the 28 pages that were redacted from the report on 9/11. And in that New Yorker article, he talks about how there was a memorandum of advice, which was an implicit threat of a clerical coup from the Wahhabis. So they were really threatening to just completely overthrow the Saudis, because they had done this sacrilege of hosting American bases on Saudi Arabian soil. And so sort of the compromise, the way to appease them after that was to set up this Ministry of Islamic Affairs. And a lot of 9/11 families think that this ministry was actually involved in September 11th. And even if it wasn't, it was involved in radicalizing people in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny. You heard me struggling trying to remember that footnote. what a disaster for live radio that was. But yeah, I'm glad I remembered it too. Yeah, and Lawrence Wright is a good source for that as well. And then, and yeah, you know, this is, Greg Palast talked a lot about how, you know, in the 1990s and in the time leading up to the September 11th attacks, that the Saudis were paying a lot of money to Al-Qaeda, basically as protection money, and through these kind of groups. I don't know if it's exactly this group, but mostly just as protection money. Just go blow up somebody else and leave us alone, was basically the message. But then, of course, it was helping them get away with a lot of their plans and what they were trying to get away with.
Right, right. And then after that, there was, that led to a whole different phase, because 9/11 led to the Iraq War, which, the Saudis opposed. And it created what the Saudis, and especially the Sunni Wahhabis, thought was a very threatening Shia crescent, extending from Iran through the new Shia dominated Baghdad regime in Iraq, and into Syria and into Hezbollah's turf in Lebanon. And so they started, the Saudis, and including private Saudi wealth, started really turning on the money spigot to support radical Sunni rebels in Lebanon and in Syria. And eventually they were able to help Israel and other factions turn Washington policy around to go against the Shias in what Seymour Hersh called the redirection. And this is where Washington first started really supporting radical Sunni Islamists in Syria. And then Obama continued that policy. And that is what really made ISIS bounce back, because the Sunni awakening in Iraq, that had really trounced ISIS. ISIS was really at a nadir before the 2011 Arab Spring war in Syria. But then with all this influx of money and CIA training and supplies from Saudi Arabia and the United States and Qatar and Turkey, ISIS was able to bounce back from that, and they were able to conquer parts of Syria. And from there, stage the conquest of Western Iraq, which leads us to the crisis that we're at now and leads us to the new Iraq war that we're faced with.
Right. And leads us to the question of what's going on in Saudi Arabia right now. Again, are the masses of Wahhabi led, you know, just regular Joe Saudi Arabians right now looking at ISIS as, you know, inspired and wanting to see something much more like that as the regime in Saudi Arabia? Because after all, these princes and their solid gold airplanes, although I don't know, that may have been a guy from UAE with the solid gold airplane, but they virtually, you know, metaphorically speaking, they've all got their solid gold airplanes and coke and hookers and fast cars and all of their stuff. And I know that doesn't go over very well with the regular Joe Saudi Arabians. And then they got all this going on right at their northern border. And with all of the propaganda coming out of the so-called caliph up there that, you know, this is the Bible coming true and all this kind of stuff. This is all magic. It's the way it's supposed to be. It's ordained by God. Come and join us. And like you're saying, the peninsula is where all this starts. So, you know, how long until we got black flags flying over Riyadh?
Right. You have to imagine that the true Wahhabi believers would just love to see al-Baghdadi replace the Saudis as the new caliph. And especially al-Baghdadi is himself an Islamic scholar. So he's sort of a man of their cloth anyway, of the Wahhabi clerics. And he, as Alistair Crook points out, he uses Wahhabi language in his public pronouncements. And so it really is sort of an explosive situation potentially.
Yeah. And, you know, it also, this whole discussion just drives home the point that in my mind anyway, my prejudice, but my show, that Islam, Sunni, Shia, here, there, and in a lot of places, maybe not everywhere, but in a lot of places, has been desperately in need of a reformation for a long time. And America leading and the Western foreign policy in this century and before has been absolutely the exact opposite way to achieve that, for narrow interests instead of, you know, the future of mankind or anything like that being important. We've got, because of the chaos and violence of American intervention, we have the Zarqawiites rising to the top, the lowest two-bit rapist, suicide bomber scumbags in charge because of Bush and Obama and the American foreign policy consensus now.
Right. I mean, I like to call ISIS extremophiles, that they're like the biological microorganisms that thrive in extreme temperatures, and they thrive in conditions of war and chaos. And that's what the United States has been exporting all along. And not only that, but also just their direct foreign policy, that they've been helping the Saudis support the Afghan Mujahideen in the 1980s. And they've been helping with the redirection policy in Syria, and they've been helping Islamist rebels in Libya. And just more generally, they've been propping up this Saudi regime that beheads far more people than ISIS does over apostasy and sorcery and these kinds of things. And it's propping up this billionaire state propagator of radical Islam that is, like I said, just predicated, that it owes its very, the regime's very existence to propagating radical Islam, because it depends on the sanction of these radical Wahhabi clerics.
Yep. All right. Well, we're over time, so I want to make sure that people go one more time and tell them, playing with fanatic fire, how the Saudis and the U.S. have perilously exploited radical Islam in their pursuit of power. It's at antiwar.com/blog, and it's also at dansanchez.me, and come on, cursor, and medium.com. Thanks very much for your time, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Great to talk to you.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others.
The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to FFF.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is our friend Eric Margolese. Oh, yeah, I should have called you on Skype. I forgot about that. I didn't get my head organized about these things. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you doing?
Thank you, Scott. I'm watching events unfold in confusing Yemen with considerable interest.
Yeah, me too, only I don't have the context to understand it, which is why I got you on the phone. But before I ask you to explain the context, I want to explain you. Eric Margolese, why, he's a journalist, has been for many decades and covered a lot of wars, and he wrote the books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and you can find his website at ericmargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis, ericmargolese.com. And you can find what he writes also at lourockwell.com and at uns.com, U-N-Z, uns.com. And, of course, we run him in the viewpoint section all the time at antiwar.com, including, I think, today. Now that we got all that out of the way, tell me, what's a Yemen? What's going on in Yemen?
Well, the answer is nobody really knows. It's what diplomats call a fluid situation, very confusing. A U.S.-installed regime in Sana'a, the capital of this very, very remote country, southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. About 25 million people. Nobody knows. They can't count them because they're moving around. A very wild country. Northerners from who are known as Houthis. Here's another new name for us to deal with, who are kind of Shiites, mm-hmm. Shiite lights, have been fighting the central government in Sana'a, which is backed by the U.S., and they have now advanced on the capital, are in the capital, have seized some of the buildings, are trying to oust the government, it seems, unless they can come to a last-minute deal. And the U.S. is involved in this because the CIA and U.S. Air Force have been regularly bombing and attacking in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. And of course, they're attacking supposedly al-Qaeda targets, but who else? Do they attack the Houthis? Because I know that there's a lot of propaganda about how, anywhere there's a Shia, then that means that the Ayatollah Khamenei is behind it over there in Iran.
Yes, the U.S. Air Force had bombed Houthis over recent years. They killed one of the senior Houthi leaders. It was described as a Saudi intervention, but it was obviously U.S. Air Force, probably flying out of the increasingly important U.S. Secret military base in Djibouti on the other side of the Red Sea in what used to be French territory. So the CIA is all involved on the ground, and I think almost weekly we're getting reports of drone strikes against various of Houthis or other rebels, because Yemen is full of rebellious tribes, and down south in what used to be Aden, the British colony of Aden, there is another independence movement there that is also fighting the government in Sana'a. Mm-hmm.
And now this guy, Hadi, he's Hillary Clinton's handpicked successor to Saleh, who was the American sock puppet dictator before, correct?
That's correct.
And so then the prime minister, Basandawa, who has resigned, he's resigning now because of what exactly? Because Hadi refuses to compromise with the Houthis, or because he's been made to?
I think probably because he's worried about his life.
Yemeni, just needs to get out of town is all.
Exactly. Yemeni politics often involve lead poisoning. And these are very wild and crazy people. Yemen, when I first went to Yemen, I think it was in 1976, it was just creeping into the 8th century A.D., and the capital, Sana'a, was surrounded by walls, with gates, and at dusk, somebody would go up and blow this ram's horn, and they would close the gates for the night. Everybody's walking around with guns and daggers. I loved it. It was straight out of the Old Testament.
I mean, in other words, it's not really a state anyway, but I guess maybe it is. That was a long time ago. When was the last time you were there?
Oh, this must be about 1990-something. It's quite a while.
Yeah.
It's not a place you want to rush back to.
I did see a anti-war propaganda video against the drone strikes in Yemen that showed pretty modern city and kids in Western dress on their little playground and whatever. A sophisticated and, I think, successful attempt to westernize in place of humanize them, because human ain't good enough, of course. Western really helps.
Well, that's right. And what that video was showing was there was some oil that was hit in Yemen, and the Americans poured in, and a lot of money came in, much of which was stolen or skimmed off, but some of it ended up putting up modern buildings in a more modern section in the capital. But old Yemen still remains, and what's important is that it is a tribal society like Afghanistan, and while there's sort of a modicum of westernized culture in the capital, the rest of the country is still run by tribal chiefs and feuds and fights. And the other notable thing about Yemen is that everybody's stoned in the country. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, everybody stops work, and the guys all get together, and they chew this narcotic shrub called khat, Q-A-T. And it gives you a mild high. It's like a cross between pot and coke. And it's very convivial. Everybody sits and chats and laughs and has a good time. But they get stoned, and nobody eats. That's why lots of Yemenis are very skinny.
Well, it seems like they'd all be getting along if they... Maybe they needed to just switch to weed, but... Anyway, well, so... Now, the deal is, though, is the Houthi rebellion is always, well, and up in the north, there's the Houthi rebellion, but now they're in the capital city. Was this a big, unexpected event that they were able to come and take this much territory and force whatever change, I guess, they're attempting
to
force
now? Well, it was. It was, it's a blow for the imperial forces in Washington, who are using Yemen to suppress rebels there, but also to monitor the mouth of the Red Sea. And there was talk that the Houthis were somehow playing footsie with the Iranians, both being Shiites, and that the Iranians were gaining influence in Yemen. And, of course, this set off alarm bells in Washington, and they had to rush more drones and more CIA agents to Yemen. But in the end, Yemen is a largely ungovernable country. It's very wild, very primitive, as I said, very mountainous, and the only part of the Arabian Peninsula that has any rain. So, and it has a large population that's probably almost as large as Saudi Arabia, which causes great worry to Washington.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that.
Well, that's the undercover worry about Yemen. Nobody really gives a hoot about Yemen. But there are about between 2 and 3 million Yemeni immigrants in Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of them was the father of Osama bin Laden. And, he's dead now, but in the past they came. And they're still coming across the border. And there's concern that these radicalized Yemenis may form the basis for some kind of attempt to overthrow or change the Saudi dynasty. Great worry.
Oh, man. I was just about to ask you a thing, and now the music's playing, which means we got to go out and take this break. But hang tight, Eric. We'll be back in a few minutes with you. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be back in a few minutes with Eric Margulies at ericmargulies.com. We're talking about the situation in Yemen. And then I'm going to ask him some Islamic State stuff, too. And that's going to be very interesting right after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line with Eric Margulies from ericmargulies.com. Talking about Yemen, where the Houthis are on the march. Well, they've signed a deal, it says here, with Yemen parties to form a new government. And they took it. They occupied a bunch of buildings and said, let us into the government. We're not really asking. And then, so apparently they signed a deal. Hey. That could have been worse. I don't know exactly how many people have been killed leading up to this, but that's better than things could be sometimes. I wonder whether you would make the parallel, Eric, between Pakistan policy, where they let us bomb inside their country as long as we'll kill their government's enemies, along with the ones that our government's looking for, in, as you mentioned, drone strikes against these Houthi rebels. Or I guess it's maybe not quite the same thing, since, as you say, they equate the Houthis with the Iranians. So that's at least makes it pretty easy for the Yemenis to convince them to help. But then, so I wonder if you'd make that parallel for what it's worth. And then I wonder whether you think that maybe that's helped lead to the so-called, at least, crisis such as it is right now, where they're now more powerful, strong enough to demand real participation in the government and the capital as never before.
That is a good comparison, a good analogy. The U.S. influence in Pakistan is largely expressed through cash. We have bought off many of the political and military leaders in Pakistan with consulting payments. And in exchange for that, they're letting the U.S. run around and bomb their citizens in the tribal territories. Yeah, same thing in Yemen. U.S. is main supplier of cash for that dirt-poor country. All the generals and politicians and so on are on our payroll one way or another, and they do what they're told. But there may be change because there's great unhappiness in Yemen over these drone strikes and other bombing, American Special Forces operations. We've kicked another hornet's nest, and the hornets are getting out their stingers.
Yeah, it seems like... Geez, I'm trying to remember, Eric, I'm sorry, my footnote, the last long-form piece of journalism I read about, oh, I know who it was, Gregory Johnson, had written this really long thing for maybe The Atlantic or something about if we you know, blow up your wedding, we'll pay you $80,000, something like that was in the title of it, real long-form piece there, and he talked about just how with every single drone strike, or, you know, Tomahawk missile or whatever it is, or JSOC raid or exactly how it goes down. Every killing by the Americans there, they just rally more and more people to Al-Qaeda's cause. And even where you have meetings, and maybe this is deliberate, I don't know, I don't mean to be that bad of a kook about it, but meetings where the local tribal leaders have summoned the Al-Qaeda people to basically, you know, bend them to their will. And say, listen, here's the line around here. I'm the big boss around here, not you. And here's how it's going to be. And then America comes by and drones the three of them, right? Including the tribal chief who was putting Al-Qaeda in check and this kind of thing. And they've just created a huge problem where before it was just the switchboard house. You know, the father-in-law of the 9/11 hijacker guy that lived there and his 10 friends. Now it's a real movement, apparently.
Well, it's true. We've seen exactly the same thing in Afghanistan. Even President Karzai there, the outgoing president, has said that these drone attacks are doing nothing but mainly killing civilians And for everyone killed, 10 people are joining Taliban in Afghanistan. Same thing in Yemen. There's great fury over this. We don't understand how much these societies are ruled by the desire and the need for revenge. So clearly, we're by the so-called war on terror is really almost a war against the United States ourselves, because we are generating more anti-American forces than even we can deal with.
Mm-hmm. Well, which brings me to exactly what I wanted to ask you about, really, which is the threat to the American people here. It was kind of a funny spectacle where I'm the paranoid, and I have a former CIA officer, Phil Giraldi, on the line a couple of segments back, and I'm saying, oh, no, I think these terrorists are going to get us. And Giraldi's saying, nah, don't worry about it. It's all a big hyped-up threat. And obviously there is a big hyped-up threat because they're trying to scare us into letting them go back to full-scale war here and all that. No question about that. And you know, as we're sitting here talking about radicalizing Al-Qaeda members in Yemen, we got to acknowledge Yemen is a long way from here. And, you know, sending some printer cartridges full of non-functioning explosives in the belly of a plane is not an existential threat, it doesn't seem like. You know what I mean? They haven't been able to launch or manage any kind of real attack against us. I guess the underpants bomber was close. But so there is that, but then on the other hand, we're talking about raw numbers, and they only got to get lucky once and all those kind of cliches. So I wonder, what do you think is the real threat to the United States, not just to our so-called interests over there, but to the American people from all the enemies our government's been creating over all this time?
I absolutely think that the biggest threat to the United States is from its own hawkish, warlike factions in Washington who are cutting back on civil liberties and who have created this monstrous espionage apparatus and moving us rapidly to 1984, back to 1984, all under the guise of national security. I shudder every time I hear this expression. Look, there is no great threat to the United States and the Middle East. That is absolutely absurd. The claims that are being made are childish and hysterical, like ISIS sneaking over the border from Mexico, disguised as cantaloupes, something like that. You know, we've become hysterical. We're a nation of over 300 million people. We can absorb any attacks that come. We can't allow ourselves to live in terror and fear and hype. But turn on the TV these days, and all you get is intense fear mongering. And unfortunately, the average American is not sufficiently educated or wise to the ways of the world to understand that this is all just propaganda.
Yeah. Now, see, I'm kind of in a unfortunate position propaganda-wise, because my real thing is, yeah, I'm paranoid, but I think the best solution is to stop intervening, which makes it sound like, oh, I think America should back down to the danger or whatever. But the point is, hell, even on Fox News, they talk about, gee, even the Republican senators say, are we just poking a hornet's nest with no plan to actually take care of the hornets? And, of course, the Republicans by that mean sending the ground troops, that'll get rid of them, but we already know better than that. But, you know, that seems to be the frame of it, and I just wonder how many hornet's nests you can bash open with a bat without expecting for things to happen. And I'm more concerned then, of course, about, you know, how Americans react to any attacks, you know, giving even more blank checks to our government to do even greater damage over there. It just seems like, you know, they've succeeded in creating the terrorist threat that they always pretended existed out there. You know, I don't know.
Well, exactly. I don't know. Our government, I've never seen such a blundering government. It makes even the Bush administration look somewhat competent. The policy's going all different ways. It's being made by amateurs in the White House and National Security Council, who don't know anything about world affairs or military affairs for that matter. And yes, we're sticking our nose everywhere. And of course we're going to get stung. In fact, I wrote in my book, American Raj, I had a quote from one of my columns that was a week before 9/11 saying it's only a matter of any day now the United States is going to be struck. And it's obvious we're creating enemies everywhere we go. And not only are we lowering our profile here, we almost got in a war with Russia over Ukraine and nuclear armed powers. Our troops are now spreading out all over Africa. There's a recipe for more problems. And now Obama, Nobel Peace Prize winner, is talking about expanding the war into Iraq, which could go into Iran, and Afghanistan is a mess, and Pakistan is a mess. And, of course, don't forget the pivot to Asia. Whatever happened to that? I don't know.
Well, and, you know, whatever happened to the border dispute between ISIS and Jordan that broke out back a couple of few weeks ago, Eric? What happens when ISIS sacks the king's castle there and the Israelis cross the river? Then you got ISIS and Iran on the same side at that point, right?
That's right. The situation is hopelessly confused. The people in Washington making policy are too ignorant of Middle East affairs to manage them. We're pulling strings. We don't know what's happening there. And the Israelis, as you say, are considering entering the fray, which also means attacking Lebanon. What's going to happen with the Turks? We don't know. But we have created one unholy mess there, and nobody knows how to get us out of it.
Do you think there's any actual danger to the Jordanian army from ISIS? They seem pretty successful with their suicide bombing tactics and whatever. They take city after city.
Nuisance value. ISIS's capability has been wildly exaggerated. A bunch of guys in pickup trucks are not.
But what about the Jordanian army and their actual capabilities?
It's very good.
Oh, yeah?
It's a very crack army. What used to be known, when was known as the Arab Legion years ago, was the best army in the Arab world. British trained, used to be British officered, and it can take care of itself very well. But Jordan is an American protectorate. If they can't, the Americans and the British will send in troops, as they always do. It's part of our American Raj for ruling the Mideast.
Right. I wonder if it's within the Likud party's plan, though, for the Israeli Raj. Go ahead and we're coming for you, Euphrates River, someday kind of thing. But for now, at least, just create, the occupied territory of the East Bank of the Jordan River and work on that for a while.
Well, Israel has had a two-track policy there for years. They've been saying that really Jordan is the Palestinian state. And they should expel all their Palestinians, shove them into the Jordanian desert. Already 60% of the Jordanian population are Palestinians. And the other thing is now the new initiatives come out of the Israelis. There's talk about building a new Palestinian state around the Gaza open-air prison. And Israelis have asked the dictator in Egypt, General Field Marshal al-Sisi, to give them some desert scrubland around Sinai to create a new Palestinian state that would allow the Israelis to ethnically cleanse the rest of the Palestinians with less opprobrium from abroad.
Mm. Yeah, well, here's their other option. They can just go ahead and push all the Palestinians out of East Jerusalem and the West Bank, maybe into the river, across the bridge, into the Transjordan, into Jordan, and then call that the two-state solution and go ahead and take Judea and Samaria. I don't know if they really, would do that, but then again, would the Americans stop them? And isn't that really the only question of what they can get away with or not?
Well, the recent shelling of Gaza were over 2,100 Palestinians. 70% of them civilians were killed by the Israelis using American weapons. I mostly American weapons, was a graphic message to us that nobody's going to stop the Israelis, that the United States' hands are tied. Congress will do whatever Israel tells it to do. The president doesn't have the strength, particularly not this one, to stop the Israelis. The election, American elections are coming up, and there'll always be American elections coming up. Politicians are scared to antagonize friends of Israel. So the Israelis are now feeling their oats. They've seen all their enemies collapse. They practically run Egypt now. The last country that opposed Israel, Syria, that's gone. There's only Iran way off in the distance. So it's very, Israel is emerging as the 800-pound gorilla in the Mideast, and its territorial designs may not have been fully fulfilled yet.
God dang. Well, I kind of think we shouldn't go down this line of questioning anymore. I don't want to encourage them at all. Like, man, those guys are really right. We can get away with anything.
They can.
Yeah, because, I mean, really, you know, joking about the Euphrates River and all of that, that's anything. That's in the plan for greater Israel someday. Hey, why not sooner than later?
Jeez. Well, now is a great time for them to do it. To be, they own, the Israelis control Congress, a lot of the American media, and they have a president who is scared of his own shadow at this point. And of course, they've got Hillary Clinton coming down the pike. So everything's looking good for the Israelis.
Yeah, and pretty good pretext in ISIS in Western Iraq too. So
that's right.
There you go. All right, well, I've already kept you way over longer than I meant to here, but thanks very much for your time, Eric. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Thanks a lot. That's Eric Margulies, everybody. He's at ericmargulies.com. And I got to start asking people permission. Can I keep you a third segment instead of just going on and on? Because people got errands to run, but then they don't want to be rude and say, hey, cut me loose here. And then, you know, I don't. Anyway. The great Eric Margulies, everybody, American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and War at the Top of the World. That one's all about Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Kashmir, and India, and all that conflict over there, and all that. Yep. The great Eric Margulies. All right. So, yeah, I don't know. That's, we're talking by the end of the conversation. We're on the slippery slope argument now about Israel going ahead and taking advantage of this crisis to kick the Palestinians out into Jordan. But, you know, I think, you know, as he said, when I said, yeah, there's nobody can stop the Israelis except the Americans, he goes, Americans can't stop them either. There's nobody can stop them. They're going to do what they want. And, you know, I mean, all they got to do is cite Andrew Jackson and they'll have the American people support him, right? Sometimes them Cherokee, as docile as they may be, have just got to go. And everyone will yell USA, USA, and then all the Palestinians will have to sink or swim. I don't know. That's a nightmare scenario, but what's the alternative from the point of view of the Israeli Likud party? Put yourself in their shoes. What are they going to do? Stop occupying the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip? Let these people have the slightest bit of dignity and autonomy? Give them a pseudo-state and call it a state? Nope. They're not going to do that. They're not going to give up a thing. Like Margulies just said, look at what they just did in Gaza. Obama objects and they go, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Pay me? That's what I thought. And on it goes. And in fact, you know all those stories, Obama sends weapons to Israel as they bomb Gaza. Actually, as the Wall Street Journal reported, that was the Israelis screwing Barack Obama and the Americans. They have what's called an advanced weapons store over there, full of American weapons, as though Israel is actually an ally of the United States and would ever fight by America's military side in any kind of major conflict over there. We got to keep them out of all of our conflicts because they're all for Israel and we got to pretend they're all not. So anyway, it's just an excuse to pad the Israelis' weapons stores and you know, it's just a paper category of weapons transfer to Israel and money from your pocket to the bank accounts of the stockholders and dividend check receivers of the Lockheed Martin Corporation there. So anyway, that's pretty much how that works. And what the Israelis did, they raided the weapons store, and then they leaked it as, Obama gives us more weapons in the middle of the fight. Thanks, Obama. When what they're really doing was taking all that stuff, stealing it, so to speak, without asking, and then saying, thanks a lot for replenishing all our shells, as they're just basically randomly shelling the Gaza Strip from their artillery pieces and their tanks. Just blasting whoever happens to be somewhat near what they were kind of aiming at. And Obama's State Department at one point said, hey, man, you guys are targeting UN hospitals here. And this is, I don't know, what, unconscionable or whatever word they used to say, like, we are officially registering our diplomatic disapproval. And, of course, the Israeli response, I don't even think they responded. They just silently shrug and continue on. They don't care. What are you going to do? Keep paying me? Netanyahu was heard mumbling. Yeah, it's a catastrophe. And, yeah, you know, I agree with Margulies, too, about the ISIS threat being overblown. See, I sound like I'm contradicting myself, but I'm not really, I don't think. It only takes a couple of kooks to get through. No power at all. It takes nothing to get a couple of kooks through, past customs, past European and American intelligence services, and then hit a soft target in America. You can come up with 100 examples of, you know, places where it would be easy for some kook to commit a crime and yell Allah Akbar at the end of it and make a big deal out of it. That'd be easy to do. It doesn't take a million-man army over there. It doesn't take anything. It doesn't even take for them to be an Islamic state at all, for them to be a terrorist threat. And I still think it's in their interest to try to provoke us. And I think that's playing out in front of our eyes, that they would like us to go to war back against them over there. And, you know, to for their own public relations, and to further the plan of continuing to bankrupt the United States, as Bin Laden outlined it way back before 9/11 and since. Especially in his 2004 speech where he says, all I have to do is send a piece of cloth to Mujahideen with a piece of cloth upon which it is written Al-Qaeda. And the Americans, you'll send all of your generals and all of your billions of dollars racing to confront the threat. And I'll just keep doing it to you over and over again until I've completely bled you to bankruptcy and forced you out. And as Zawahiri complained, we don't want the Americans to leave yet, back when, you know, Bush announced the withdrawal plan back in 2008. We don't want them to leave. We need them to stay until they've lost many more soldiers and spent many more billions of dollars on this project. It's not over yet. And so here goes Obama, just like Bush before him, fulfilling every whim of the American people's enemies. It's crazy. I guess I'm happy to hear, in a sense, just on the narrow point from Eric Margulies there, that the Jordanian army is powerful enough to protect their border. Don't worry about that, at least. I guess I didn't really ask him about the threat from within there. Can't say I've heard of any suicide bombings in Jordan since Zarqawi, though, back in 06, right? So. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, wrapping up for the day. I'm so hungry. Thanks for listening. My thing is, I hate the wars, and I try to debunk the excuses for them as best I can. That's basically the shtick here. And all I got to tell you is that I ain't lying on purpose anyway. Try to provide footnotes when I can. Let me just say real quick, isn't it something about the Secret Service failing to prevent a fence jumper from getting in through the front door of the White House? What's going on there? I mean, I know, close enough for government work, right? And it serves the damn Democrats right for sucking so bad and being Democrats and being the government and everything, but... I mean, there is actually a Secret Service security guard whose job it is to control that sector of lawn, correct or not? And where was he? And what's his name? What the hell happened to his German Shepherd? And how in the hell does that happen? I don't know. You get the idea, the Secret Service doesn't give a damn what happens to Barack Obama at all. I don't know. What would you think if you were the president and you heard, oh, yeah, I guess we're going to have to tell you because it's going to be in the news that, Mr. President, yeah, if you'd been home, you'd have been in terrible danger. Yeah. No, actually, and then it turns out they claim, and what is this, a storybook or something? I don't know. They say that the motive of the guy literally is that the sky is falling. The atmosphere is collapsing, says the madman with the knife who hopped the fence and made it through the front door. I don't know. I guess crazier stuff has happened at the White House. Atmosphere's collapsing, huh? I don't know. That could happen. You know, like if acorn fell on your head and you were a small chicken. Anyway, I don't know what to make of it. I don't have a conspiracy theory. Maybe I should come up with one. Nah. Anyway, he wasn't even home, the president at the time. All right. So now back to what's really important here is trying to challenge the myths of this war again in Iraq and in Syria. I'm watching TV, and TV has one thing to say about this. And yeah, I'm watching Fox News, but this is pretty much the shtick everywhere. And the shtick is, sorry for the pause there, the shtick is that we gotta send more troops to Iraq. You gotta send troops. You can't just defeat these guys with air power. You gotta send troops. That's what TV says. And then in Syria, we gotta back the rebels. Gotta back the rebels. Come on, any plan in Syria that doesn't include building an entire new moderate army from scratch out of what's now the FSA in order to fight ISIS, Nusra, will it include Ahrar al-Sham or not? Nobody knows. And to fight the Syrian state backed by Hezbollah and Russia. And an army with air power and tanks. It's just... Look, man, here's the thing about it. Simply put, the plan in Iraq to send in the drones and the planes can't work. It can only make these guys... propaganda succeed, that they're the persecuted victims of the evil Americans, and yet they're brave enough to stand up to us, and the Americans are such cowards, they will only bomb from the air like some limp-wristed Democrat and not put their guys in danger because of what sissies they are, blah, blah, blah. And then the Fox News guys, of course, they have the Pentagon shtick down past. The same story you heard about Afghanistan in 2009. We got to send more troops. We gotta send more troops. The president is insubordinate. The president is refusing to bend to the will of the generals who know what to do. They're the generals, and they say surge. They say troops on the ground, boots on the ground. We gotta go and put bullets in these guys. It's the only way to get it done. And that kind of pressure, as we saw in 2009, is irresistible. On a Democrat. Like, maybe if you had a real kind of tough guy, Richard Nixon type Republican, you know, not some idiot pushover like George W. Bush or just some guy who is absolutely irredeemable in every single way, like his father. But like somebody who was such a bastard that he could win on his own, had the influence, the power to shout them down somehow. I'm more right-wing than you. I can go to China if I want, and you can't stop me because I'm Nixon. That kind of thing. Maybe a Republican like that could face him down. But Barack Obama, guilty of the high crime of insubordination to his generals who demand he escalate the war day after day, week after week, month after month on TV, where that's all any commentator can say. They can never say, all right, it is true that it is American policy that made it this way, but they can't even say that. Just, oh my God, more must be done because whatever it is not enough. That's the only narrative. And Obama, well, what's he going to do? I promise there's not going to be ground troops when there's already almost 2,000 guys, probably more, and include the Special Operations Command, SOCOM, and the Joint Special Operations Command, which is different, which is completely outside of the chain of command of the Army and the Secretary of Defense and answer directly to the President. And I think that's still the way it is. I guess maybe he put them under the Secretary of Defense, but they're not under the Pentagon or under the Secretary of the Army. I know that much. Ask Nick Turse, maybe. But anyway, the Special Forces guys are there, and of course the CIA is there, and whatever mercenaries they've hired, and whatever killers. And you need the Special Forces guys on the ground to point laser pointers at the targets so that the planes can hit them. They don't laze their own targets. They need that kind of thing done from the ground still. And that's how the technology works, I guess. So I'm sorry. I'm trying to get to the point, and I'm not. They're going to bomb them and bomb them and bomb them. It's not going to dislodge them. The president is going to eventually bend to the will of the attacks from the right, and he's going to put troops on the ground, and that is maybe going to succeed. I mean, you got to figure how many brigades of Army and Marines he's got to put on the ground to sack Tikrit, Mosul, and Fallujah at least. And then what? Like probably Bakuba and a few other too? It only takes, you know, the Islamic State forces, not very many guys to take over these cities because there's a giant power vacuum and this and that. But for the Americans to come and not just kick them out, but hold the ground, because they're going to turn and run anyway when the Americans come. They're not even going to really fight other than a token force. They're going to live to fight another day when it comes to that. But for the Americans to feel secure occupying the cities with enough force that they can provide force protection for themselves and each other while they're there for the long term, for the medium term, you're talking a lot of guys. And it's just, man, it's crazy. It's like a rocket skateboard on the road to hell, man. It's just coming. And then on the other side, the policy in Syria. You know, I asked Phil Giraldi, I don't know if this was during the break or if you guys heard this part or whatever, where I'm saying, yeah, but okay, so these are the conditions of the Syria intervention here. So how the hell is this going to work? What's going to happen? And he goes, well, it's going to blow up. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be bad. It ain't going to work. I don't know. Nobody knows what to predict except disaster. Except that on the face of it, the argument about how this war is to be won doesn't work. And so now, take the most plausible explanation for victory. America just goes ahead and allies with the Ayatollah's regime in Iran, outright allies with the sectarian Shiite forces in Baghdad, admittedly so, allies with the Shiite Baathist government in Syria, and say, all right, we'll do the air cover, you guys do the ground troops, Hezbollah, lead from the west, go in there and kick these guys' asses. That's possible, but can you imagine the blowback from that? The backdraft from that blowing up right in our face, absolutely taking the Shiite side in this. Right now, America's policy is so two-faced and double-crossing in its nature that both sides are convinced that America supports the other, and they're both kind of right, at least. But to outright take the Shiite side against them, or what? You're going to put in a combination of the Iranians and the Saudis? The Saudis ain't going to fight. They're not going to field an army in Iraq in order to dislodge the Islamic State. The Jordanians, as Margulies said, they may be able to seal that border tight, but go past it into the Euphrates Valley and dislodge the Islamic State? Not on your life. So here's the beginning of a war that anyone can tell you Even if you had Ike Eisenhower running the damn thing or whatever, ain't gonna happen, not in a million years, and so we're gonna do it anyway. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.